You're listening to Lead, Sell, Grow the Human Experience Podcast. I am your host, Eric Konovalov, and I believe that we can achieve everything we want if we take our leadership, sales ability, and personal growth to a higher level. On this show, we share ideas on how to break through our invisible boundaries, start taking steps towards our dreams, and create the life we desire. I invite you to open your mind to new possibilities, new ideas, and to the truth that everything you want is possible for you. Thank you for being here and welcome to the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Lead, Sell, Grow the Human Experience Podcast. I'm smiling ear to ear because I know you guys are going straight to our Facebook group, joining in and connecting with us there on Lead, Sell, Grow the Human Experience Tribe. And the other reason I'm smiling ear to ear is because I have the famous Andy Paul on the show today. If you don't know who Andy is, his hit Accelerate Your Sales podcast was acquired by Ring DNA in 2020, since renamed Sales Enablement with Andy Paul. The show continues to inspire thousands of sales professionals each week. Andy has also written two award-winning sales books, Zero Time Selling and Amp Up Your Sales. Plus, he's got a new one coming out soon that we're going to talk about. He's ranked number 8 on LinkedIn's list of top 50 global sales experts, and he has consulted with some of the biggest businesses in the world, including Square, Philips, Grubhub, and more, making him one of the leading voices in the sales industry today. And we got him right here to pick his brain. Right, Andy, welcome to the show. How are you?
Eric, thank you for that very generous introduction. I'm doing great. Pleasure to be here with you.
Very cool. So tell me about your kind of, how did you grow up in sales and in the transition into becoming like the sales guru that you are today? Can I call you a sales guru?
I guess. I don't know. There's probably lots of people that claim that title.
We only have sales gurus on my show.
So, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I'm honored to be one then. Gosh, my journey to sales started when I was selling women's shoes at JCPenney back in the day when JCPenney was the anchor of every mall in America. And I'm sorry, before I went to school, but it was a good learning experience about putting the customer first. And yeah, after I came out of college, I just sort of aimless, I guess, in some respects, but I had this insatiable curiosity, learning desire, and was very competitive, and sales sort of appealed to me. So I sort of fell into sales at that point and started selling at what time was called Burroughs, second largest computer company in the world. Went there selling computer systems to the construction industry primarily, and did well. I got promoted quickly, and after been there for a few years, I started encountering this. We were selling these systems that in today's dollar sell for starting about $250,000 or more. And one time, so one of my sellers, the guys that work for me, said, well, we're going to close this big deal tomorrow. And so in today's terms, we're about $250,000 deal with a tire distributor. Talked to the CEO today. He's all set to go. We're going to close. Come with me. I said, great. I'll go with you. Close the deal. And when we get there, the CEO says, well, not going to be able to buy from you today. It's like, well, why? You just said yesterday you're going to. He said, well, yeah, last night I went to a computer store. And this was at the dawn of the personal computing revolution.
What years are we talking about here?
This is 81.
81. Okay, awesome. Yeah. I was already born, just to let you know.
Okay, in case well, I was you a little concerned about that. Yeah. No. And he turns around and on his credenza behind his desk is an Apple II. And he said, the guy at the computer store said that this thing for $2,000 can do everything that what your product at the time was a $70,000 system. $70,000 system could do. I'm like, no, but that started happening more frequently. And I was like, oh, huh. Well, maybe I should make a change. So I went to work for Apple in the early days. That was a sort of long story to lead up into it. And ran small business marketing for Apple for a couple of years because that had been my specialty, selling in small business. So I was sort of like a software evangelist for them. My job was to go out and get companies to write business applications for the Apple II and Apple III and soon to be the Mac computer, because this is before the Mac was introduced. that sort of set me on a journey of working with a variety of startups through Silicon Valley, both in the computer industry as well as the wireless and satellite communications business. Spent a lot of time selling very large, complex satellite communication systems to major enterprises around the world, working for startups. And that sort of gave me the idea eventually to say, look, I want to get off airplanes, traveling hundreds of thousands of miles every year. I want to stay closer to home and be there for my kids more. So started my own company in the year 2000 to help small companies learn how to sell big deals. And so I worked with a variety of companies, started doing that until 2011. I started the bug to write my first book. And I think it's just gonna be like a calling card for, as most consultants, write my book as a calling card. Actually turned out to be kind of a popular book and sort of set me on this path today where writing, being a thought leader, quote unquote, thought leader, if you will, out there. Started my podcast in 2015 and here I am.
Wow. So, I mean, sounds like consistency has been the name of your game. You stuck with one thing.
Well, actually, sort of yes and no. I mean, I count the sort of like seven or so different chapters in my career where I've had to sort of reinvent myself. And I think that's really the key. I mean, yes, consistency in the sense I've been in sales, I've been continually learning and getting better and improving my craft throughout the years, but in various different stages. I mean, I went from being selling in the personal computer industry to having to learn how to sell to major accounts. And fortunately, I had a great mentor to do that as I started entered the satellite business. And then had to learn how to become a consultant, which I really didn't know how to do. And then had to learn about writing a book and becoming an author and a podcaster. And it's just, for me, that's one of the beauties of a career is staying curious, wanting to always learn, and write new chapters for yourself.
That's so awesome. So looking at the way things were sold in the 80s, without all the CRMs, you guys probably had the little index cards back then, right?
The Rolodex, we call it.
Rolodex. Do you think it's harder to sell nowadays than it was back then? Or is it easier with all the technology?
No, I think it's just hard. I don't think it's any harder or any easier. You certainly have more tools at your disposal today, but there's mitigating factors. So you still have to reach somebody, you still have to grab their attention, you still have to have them invest some of their time and attention in you. So the basics are still the same. I think there's this mythology built up about, selling before the tech revolution that somehow is, customers are waiting by the phone, buyers answered their own phones. That's like, no, none of that's true. It was just as hard to get hold of people as it is today. Yeah, they've got more, they have an inbox with more things in it. Certainly, it makes it a little more difficult in some cases, maybe to get hold of people, but it's still the same challenges. So, whatever benefits are of technology sort of a little bit offset by the fact that there's a lot more people competing. But, we also, I grew up competing against IBM at the time, and IBM had 70% market share. Every deal was a struggle. So working for a startup selling, large complex systems where it's mission critical applications, communication systems that people are buying, how you convinced people that it was a good idea to buy from a small company with no brand name, no track record. That was a lot of fun, but it was, it was an interesting challenge. So I think selling's just hard. It's hard no matter what generation you're in.
Okay. Fair enough. So as a consultant, you're going into organizations. Is there something that continues to repeat itself as far as what mistakes organizations are making today?
Yeah, all of them. I mean, that's sort of the problem, is that despite the addition of all the technology into sales, we still repeat the same mistakes that are problematic for buyers. So we still train sellers to pitch first, listen second. So the fundamental ways that we connect on as a human, we're still doing the same things we're doing forever, right? I contend that selling is fundamentally unchanged when it gets down to that human-human interaction part. That's been for 120, 130 years, when modern selling started being institutionalized in the United States. So rather than just take technology and apply it to bad behaviors, let's try different behaviors and then apply technology to it.
So how do you break that cycle? And why, I mean, everybody knows it, right? Like, why is there this huge gap between knowing you're supposed to listen and understand and care and provide a solution versus pitch? We all know it.
Right. Why? I think it starts with how we train and socialize people in the sales profession. So if you were to ask most salespeople what their job was, you'd get the answer would be something along the lines of, well, my job is to persuade a prospect to buy my product. Ugh. And so if you think that's your job, you're going to take certain actions to make that happen. And in my new book, that's titled Sell Without Selling Out. The actions you take are of the selling out variety. It's the stereotypical pushy persuasion-based or semi-sleazy sales behaviors. Well, on the other hand, if you think from the beginning, if we start socializing sellers with the ideas that what your job is your job is to listen, to understand what's the most important thing to that buyer, and then help them get that. Now, if you do that, and that's your perspective every day when you sit down to start making calls and interact with people or go out in the field, you're going to take a whole different set of actions, right? You're going to be informed by a more human-centered approach to how do I connect with this person? How do I really listen to understand what's really most important to them? And you don't go out with the assumption that that every solution to the buyer's problem is my product, which is what the selling out is. And so I call this other way of acting selling in. And here's the irony is that the way that sellers act, that buyers resist, that buyers make buyers cringe, they contribute to this stereotype we've all heard of sellers. Those are learned behaviors. When I talk about my book and the selling in, I said, you know, there's four core behaviors or attributes that drive your ability to be successful in sales based on my experience and experience of many, many others is boiled down to your ability to connect. So connection, curiosity, understanding, and generosity. Those are innate human behaviors. So if we lean into our innate human behaviors, as opposed to train sellers to act in a way that buyers just instinctively resist, that'd be a good starting point to break the cycle.
So what are some of those behaviors that, because I feel like as soon as a buyer perceives you as a seller, even on LinkedIn, just, hey, you know, looking to connect.
Well, first of all, don't say, hey, that's
right. No, I understand. But I'm just saying, like, even in the most casual way or whatever they do, as soon as they perceive you.
There's no hiding the fact that you're a seller. So
right.
Let's stop with that, right?
Correct.
Why are you trying to hide it? That is what you are. That's fine.
Because
that's great.
The reason why most people try to hide it is because the learned behavior of the buyer is that sellers want to sell me something and right away they're pushing away.
Because somebody, a seller comes in and says, let me tell you about my product. Let me pitch you, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to showing an interest in that person, just showing an interest in that person to start with, right? I mean, the way you make yourself interesting to another person is to be interested in them. So, 100%. Right? So, I mean, there's sales trainers out there, then sales managers. So you see it online buyers are so busy today. They don't have time for small talk. Just jump right into the business. So it's like, no, you're talking to a human. You know, the way humans form perceptions of other people, the way you form a connection with another person, technology hasn't changed that. I mean, they've got this whole strata of sales gurus. That's why I don't like to be called that, is that who claim that, you know, technology has changed the way people think, right? And the way we process information, the way we connect with them, human beings, the way we've evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. Suddenly that changed in 10 years. Well, that's ludicrous. We haven't. So act like a human being, be a good person, lean into that. When you start making your connection with people, you start earning some level of trust. You start earning some permission to learn more about the buyer.
I hear you, Andy. I got to challenge it because in a company, a seller's job, right? If what gets measured improves, you got to look at what the leaders are measuring, right? They're measuring their activity levels. They're measuring appointments.
Measuring the wrong things.
They're measuring the wrong things 100%. But how do you measure the right things? How do you measure the relationship building in sales? And how is it that, you know, if the seller, when they're reaching out to a potential buyer, even if they're trying to get to know the person and build that relationship and be interested in them, they know deep down inside it's solely so down the road they're able to sell them something.
Sure.
And that's not wrong. You're saying that's okay to do.
That's okay. I mean, it's what you want to, one of the critical elements of building trust with someone is to be absolutely clear about your motivations. And so if the buyer senses you're trying to hide that or deflect that, then that's problematic. But one of the things that's a, you know, conventional selling out tactic is, yeah, seller can go in with good intentions and say, you know, we're here to help you. I'm really interested in learning about you. What's most important to you? How I can help you get that. And you get in the last week of the month and the manager says, ah, we need this deal. We're not going to make our number. Go offer them a discount. Well, they're not ready to make their decision yet. No. We need to get this deal this month. And so you make that happen. And I've done this earlier in my career, right?
It's like guilty. Yeah.
You just shot the relationship in the foot because the buyer suddenly knows, no, you're just the sleazy one. Right. Mm-hmm. And your relationship is forever informed by that. It doesn't, you know, the ludicrous nature of what we would do in sales, say, let's give away 10 margin points to bring a deal into June that we're going to close in July anyway. You know, I ask sales leaders all the time. So have you done an ROI on that calculation? Done an ROI on that discount? You know, that 10% you gave away in June? You know, that make, is the payback on that? No, they have no idea. No idea. But we just do it because we think it's good business. What you're doing is you're trashing the relationship. Suddenly you're making clear your motivations. So it's okay to be and Adam Grant talks about this in his book, Give and Take, is you can be a giver with an agenda. Yeah, you know, Zig Ziglar said, you know, paraphrasing, right? You can get everything you want out of life if you help enough people get what they want in life, mm-hmm. what's most important to them. So if you let the buyer know, is look, I'm only going to do well if I make you succeed. They're fine with that. At least in my experience, I've always been fine with that. You're being open about it. They know you're there to sell them. I mean, this is the thing that's, but the fact is buyers are only going to give you their time. And increasingly this is the case, right? If they need your help, if they can do it without you, they'll do it without you. If they can, you know, educate themselves about your product and service or whatever, they will. And that's fine. We all will do that, right? There's more B2C behavior and B2B buying than ever. But when they do talk to you, when they make time to talk with you, they're doing it for a reason, because they need your help. They want your help in order to make a better decision. So why would you be salesy? And when you have that opportunity to do that, I mean, when is being salesy, being more stereotypically salesy, when is that ever the answer to any of the problems you face as a seller?
Never.
Does it help the buyer make a better decision? No.
No, pressure
them. Does it help you do a better job in a difficult situation? And, you know, I could go through a list of scenarios that salesy is never the answer. In fact, as I write about in the book, it's the one question a buyer will never ask you. So he said, I've phrased this in speaking to public groups. Oh, buyer will never ask you to raise their prices. It's like, no, I've had buyers ask me to raise the prices because they wanted to expand the scope of what they were doing. But I guarantee you, the one question a buyer will never ask is say, you know, Eric, really like the product you're selling, but I don't know, you're just not salesy enough. Could you be more salesy? They'll never ask you that, right?
They'll never ask me that.
Yeah, so why do we do it? And there's a great book out called The Catalyst by Jonah Berger, a professor at Wharton School, writing about this idea of persuasion and influence. But in there, he says that cites research that shows that as humans, we universally resist being persuaded. It's instinctive behavior. He calls it persuasion reactance. So yet it forms the heart of a lot of the way we train sellers to behave. And yeah, persuasion, when you even look at the definition of it, is sort of coercive in nature. It talks about prevailing upon somebody through the force of argument. Whereas I think influence is a different motion, because influence is about having an effect on the thoughts and actions of others without apparent force. And that's what you're looking to do. You're looking to help the buyer understand the problems that they have, the potential outcomes, identify the things that are in there that are most important to them, and then provide them a couple of options on how they can achieve that. You know, work with them to have a plan together to say, like, this is how we can help you get these things that are most important to you. If you do that in that way, and then, you know, give something of value that helps them decide that, you know, you're differentiated from everybody else, then you're on a good path. And that sort of breaks down really to the heart of that. I don't think that, talking about what sales managers manage or measure, excuse me. First of all, I don't think everything needs to be measured, because I think that's a fallacy. But
when did you come up with that idea?
Which one?
That not everything needs to be measured.
I've had it for a long time. It's like, not everything can be measured. How can you can measure what you can measure. And I think I'm a huge proponent that quota is outdated and that there needs to be a better way, because there's a British economist back in the 60s, a guy named Charles Goodhart. And he formulated this formula that's been mathematically proven out, not by me, but by other mathematicians, says that when a measure becomes a target, it loses all value as a measure. And so, and the reason being is that you optimize your processes to achieve the target. Mm-hmm. So quota, it becomes a self-fulfilling limit on how much you sell, because people optimize their process to hit the target. When if the target was made, you know, a different target in a different dimension, they might be able to sell more. And so quota, I think, given also given the fact that it's set poorly, it's set irrationally, arbitrarily, and, you know, we have this crisis of, you know, all the reports show, you know, fewer than 50% of B2B sellers attaining their quota. What's the value of it then? I mean, why do we want to put sellers in a position year after year where they're failing or perceived to be failing?
Oh, it's terrible.
It's lunacy.
Yeah.
Because basic human psychology is, you know, the way you build someone's confidence and competence is to let them experience success and build on from success to success. Now, I'll tell you where I learned that lesson. I learned that lesson initially in a Red Cross manual on how to teach swimming when I was a teenager. Because it said the important thing is, as you're teaching a little child how to swim, is they need to experience success at one level before you add a level of complexity onto it, right? And they'll gain confidence from the success. So we've known this for years. This is not new news, right? About the way we help people gain confidence and competence, growing competence, is to have them experience some success. Instead, we arbitrarily set these quotas that no one attains, and win rates plummet. And it's like, okay, well, if your win rate, let's say, is 20% or 25%, as it is throughout most of the SaaS business. So if you're only winning one of every five of your most qualified opportunities, and if practice makes perfect, what are you practicing the most? Losing.
Wow. What a good way to look at that.
So let's change things up, right? We need to rethink what we're doing, because all the data is showing that we're performing less well today than we did 10 years ago and 20 years ago and so on in B2B sales.
I mean, everything you're saying is just such common sense, yet it goes out the window. Okay, so let me ask you this. If we brought you
in. The power of institutions, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, inertia.
If we brought you into an organization right now, and it's a brand new sales force, they've never existed before, and I said, Mr. Paul, you're the guy. I really need you to create a training curriculum for this new team that's never sold before. What are the topics on your curriculum that are a must?
Well, I'd start with the change of perspective of what people's job is, right? So they understood their job differently. And
would you start with the leadership on that? Oh, because you can trade the sales team, but then the leaders come in, they're like, no, you're supposed to go sell this product.
Yeah, no. Absolutely. It starts there. It starts at the top. And this is one of the sort of enduring issues in sales is that sales leaders never feel like they have the space to make change, because they've got numbers to hit as well. And so it's always sort of, they feel like they're trying to fix the airplane while it's in flight. And that's hard. And increasingly too, I think that the sales leaders sort of feel the sense of fear that, well, everybody else is executing this playbook. You know, if I try something different and it doesn't work, I'm exposed. And so I think we've really inhibited innovation in sales. And that's a problem. So I'll give you one key example. You know, if I was starting something new, is instead of measuring quota attainment, I'd measure productivity in sales, but a specific productivity, the real productivity, not how many things did you do, not how many quantity of activities, but how many dollars of revenue do you generate per hour of selling time? That's the basic measure of productivity in the world, right? How many, a rate of output based on an input of investment, right?
Yeah.
Or a unit of investment. That's productivity. So what that measures is how effective are you in those moments where you're interacting with your buyers? That's really what we want to measure.
How would you know if it's good or not?
Well, you know it based on the total number of hours it takes somebody to generate a certain dollar of revenue. So this is not new. I was measuring or managing sales teams of this over 30 years ago. And it kept sort of as a happy accident. So I was working for a company that running sales for a company that also worked in the defense business. And so they had the requirement that everybody in the company track hours, both people involved in defense and people on the commercial side, because they used it to calculate an overhead rate on they put on their bids for the DOD. And as I was thinking about that, I said, okay, we're all tracking our hours, just like lawyers and consultants and so on. I said, well, why don't we, when we get a qualified prospect, and we're all charging to a job number, our case was overhead. I said, well, why don't we start assigning job numbers to qualified opportunities in our pipeline and have everybody charge their time to the job that they're working on? So it didn't matter whether it's a seller, sales support, sales engineering, whatever. Mm. So I could look at two sellers and say, okay, they had $10 million quotas. How many hours did it take them themselves? How many hours in aggregate? What was their demand on the rest of the organization in order to generate that amount of revenue? And so I could gauge the productivity of each individual and understand really what levers we could pull. So maybe one guy took a lot of sales engineering, but on the other hand, he was performing at a much higher level. Hey, he was leveraging his resources appropriately. Another person took a lot of sales engineering time, but was struggling to hit his number, meaning, hey, we need to work on product knowledge for this person or customer knowledge for this person because he's too reliant on sales engineering, should be more self-sufficient, just to serve an example. And so then if I were to say, okay, really our incentive then is how do we help people improve their productivity from year to year? So they improve their productivity by acquiring product knowledge, acquiring customer knowledge, acquiring upskilling in various instances in sales world, sales skills, interpersonal skills, the whole lot. Suddenly you've got, like I said, you've got more levers to pull that how you can see what the direct impact is. To me, that's a much better way to manage and look at sales and then quota. Because go ahead.
Where do you stack, or like where do you rate or get graded on the DISC test? Have you ever taken a DISC?
Yeah, it's been so long. I've done DISC and Myers-Briggs, and I don't remember.
Just curious.
Why?
Because I don't think I have not met a lot of analytical salespeople like you before.
Well, I have a story about that in my book. Actually, I posted about it on LinkedIn. Yes, is my first job working for a company called Burroughs, which time was the number two computer company in the world. After 2 weeks on the job, we got sent to a national training center to be trained. This is a big company, and they brought people in, newbies like me from all over the country for a 2 week, learn how to sell. And at the end of those 2 weeks, you're sent home with an evaluation from the instructor. And this was a time when, you know, major tech companies hired hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new grads every year, brought them into these feeder programs, and you know, the whole point was, let's winnow these out and we're going to be left with the people that are really good at the end. So the first winnowing came after the the first 2 week sales training. And so you go back to the office, you got the sealed envelope from the trainer and you hand it to your branch manager. And so, which I did. And the branch manager took it away to his office and came back into the bullpen after a few minutes and, you know, pointed his finger at me and said to come to his office. I go to his office. He's looking at the evaluation. He says, so how'd it go? How'd you think it went? I was thinking, well, that's a trap question. Fine, I think. He said, oh, that's interesting because, you know, Jim, the instructor, thinks we should fire you. And I'm like,
that's a confidence booster.
Well, yeah, when you're like, you know, 21 years old, and the first thought that comes to mind is, oh shit, what am I gonna tell my parents, right?
Yeah.
He says, because he said, you're too analytical. You'll never make a good salesperson. That was the assessment. It's too analytical, would never make a good salesperson. And yeah, I happen to think it's to your advantage to be analytical, because
it is.
What we are, we're problem solvers, ultimately. If you don't picture yourself as being a problem solver, then perhaps you're in the wrong business. And yeah, I have this little acronym. So what you're looking for is COPS when you're hiring sellers, is you're looking for curious, open-minded problem solvers. So I like analytical people. Yeah, I'm kind of an introvert at nature, you know, certainly yeah, social situations.
Which actually, there are studies done that says that they make the best salespeople because they're not going to go in there and just start talking about themselves for 3 hours and how awesome they are.
No, I've never been good at that. And yeah, I have to, I said, even today in social situations, I sort of have to pull myself out of my shell to interact with folks. But yeah, I think it's, you look at the list, this is the irony, is you look at the list of attributes that companies hire for, you know, I said, I like curious, open-minded problem solvers, is, you know, you see hunter, extrovert, closer, you know, like go down the list.
That's not what the client wants.
Exactly, right? Does anybody ever ask the buyer what they want? Because you're there to help them make this decision. What help do they need from you? Do they need a hunter? Do they need a closer? Of course not.
Oh my gosh. You just gave me such an aha moment. But that's so true.
Yeah.
That's so true. I mean,
you hit the nail on the head. And we persist in this. And we also persist in using these words. And basically, you know, they're sort of exclusionary. Because a lot of people self-identify and say, well, I don't want to be that person. So I'm not going to go into sales. So as we're trying to bring, you know, a broader range of diverse candidates into sales, we have to change the vocabulary. And that's part of what we have to do, you know, around hiring and recruiting and identifying the skills and attributes we need.
So back then, I mean, you had to go out and get business. I mean, it wasn't like you could just post on LinkedIn. LinkedIn didn't exist in 81. That didn't come till like 82, probably.
Yeah, but I wish. As my son likes to say, my son's my business partner. He says, yeah, Dad, you've been in sales for 600 years.
what does a guy seen, like you?
But I've been at the forefront of so much of the tech revolution.
Yeah.
Personal computer industry. Yeah, I was a sales manager for a company. I set up retail distribution for the company that made the first battery-powered laptop computer. You know, sort of all these sort of firsts in my career, you know, first to the top of selling satellite systems, satellite communication systems. I was selling the first of their kind and in countries like India and China and the Soviet Union, even.
That's where I was born, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, I said, oh, I know. Right. And I sold the, first onboard live real-time onboard entertainment system for commercial airplanes. I mean,
that's pretty cool.
So been at the forefront of all these things, you know, it's.
But how do you do it? Like, how do you, a person who's naturally, and by the way, I'm trained in DISC and I'm big on understanding like personality styles, because I think it's important to understand that an introvert will sell differently from an extrovert. We just need to help them figure out their way. So I'm very curious. Mm-hmm. What did you have to do to kind of get out of your own way, which is completely unnatural, to go and start talking to people?
Yep.
and start connecting with people? What were, did you have some rituals or something that you did?
Yeah. I'd go stare at the walls of my apartment the first 6 months on the job or in sales are really hard. I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my territory was the East Bay area. If people are familiar with that, from like Fremont to Fairfield. So, and there are days I'd just be frustrated because we'd drive to a local business park and park the car and go door to door to door to door in a business park. And so one of my stories was, after I'd been doing it for a couple months, or maybe even a couple weeks, can't remember precisely, but I used to develop this habit at lunchtime. I'd go park at this place that was sort of near the foot of the runway of the Oakland International Airport. So it was actually this little town called San Leandro, just south of Oakland, which you could sort of drive out sort of on this peninsula, and you were airplanes coming right over your head and landing, you know, half mile away or something. But I noticed, as I was making sort of habit at that, that I saw the same cars there every day. And so one time when I was driving away after eating my lunch, yeah, I'd start looking at the people in the sitting in the driver's seat of those cars. And they were all young people like me in their three-piece suits and their white shirts and their red ties. And I just started laughing because it's like, yeah, we're all trying to sort of connect with what we need to do here. So I think for me, the turning point was, to some degree, a sort of understanding that's really a competition with myself. And I think this is one of sort of the core things about sales is every day you're competing with yourself, to your point, to go out and do things that are not natural. And you have to like that competition. You know, you have to have this desire to get better and to learn. And so for me, that phrasing it that way and framing it that way, really helped me sort of get comfortable with it, take the next step. Cause I saw it as, I was competing with myself to get better. And I've been an athlete my whole life, you know, track and cross country and swimming in high school, and, you know, still run and swim and bicycle even today. And yeah, my wife hates riding bikes with me because, you know,
you're racing her no matter what.
I'm not racing her, but if somebody comes by and passes me, she's like, okay, go ahead. And oftentimes they're way too fast and too young for me to catch, but if they're age appropriate, she'll say, okay, go ahead. I'll take off. I just have that competitive thing in me.
Yeah.
I think that's important for sellers to have.
I 100% agree with you. And when I speak to sales leaders about hiring salespeople, and when we get to, hey, let me see your job description, and I start breaking it down and asking them, like, why do you need this? Like, why do you need them to have a college degree to go sell this thing that they're selling? Why do you have to have that? Right. Well, it shows, no, it doesn't show anything. Why do you need that? Why do you need this? And we break it down, and they really have, most of the time, it's because that's what's been on that job description for 30 years, you know? And for all the sales leaders who are listening right now, you just got to understand that an introvert is going to do just as good, if not better, of a job than an extrovert. Make your company look good. They're just going to do it differently. Anybody can be a salesperson. They can, in their own way.
Well, but that's such a critical point. I mean, you're going to enjoy my book, because this is one of the subtitle of my book is Sell Without Selling Out, A Guide to Success on Your Own Terms. And as a seller, you need to develop a process that works for you and a style that works for you. And you need to insist on it. And this is one thing that's changed, become a little more difficult in sales these days, is that given the advent of so much technology, so we have much more insight and transparency into what actions sellers are taking and so on, is too many sales leaders use that as a way or as an excuse to enforce compliance to a process or compliance to a method. And to your point precisely is everybody sells in a unique fashion. And your job as a manager is not to get people to comply to your process, which you have, if your process results in a win rate of 25% across the board, that's not the one you want to emulate. Is turn people loose, give people the autonomy to experiment and become the best version of themselves, to try new things. And if it doesn't comply precisely with what you're trying to do, tough. Give people the opportunity. You know, I was fortunate in my career to have managers who, I guess, gave me enough rope to hang myself, but I delivered. And I began to insist on doing things my way. It's not my way was the sum total of the experiences, the learnings I was getting from everybody, but I was taking all that and creating sort of an Andy way of selling. And I believe that as many salespeople as are in the world, that's how many ways there are of selling.
I could not agree with you more. And where were you, or what triggered the idea for sell without selling out?
Well, it's seeing what's going on today. And, you know, through 1,000+ conversations, having my podcast with sales leaders and individual salespeople and sales thought leaders, you know, people of all, you know, different types of contributions to the selling business. And then the work.
Do you remember, sorry to interrupt you, Andy, but do you remember where you were or what, like, somebody said where that idea just like, bing, there's my next book?
Well, the title itself actually came from my editor. So, yeah, I was writing the book and I had a different title. And we were talking one day and we were saying, well, yeah, the title you have just doesn't seem to fit with what you've written.
What was your title? And,
yeah, I won't say. And it could come back again in the future. But yeah, my editor said, well, how about sell without selling out? And I was like, oh yeah, that's it. So
great title.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just need, that's the beauty of an editor when you're writing a book is you know, somebody that can basically be a collaborator. And in my case, I was very fortunate to have Amanda Lewis, my editor, working alongside me. And so, yeah, she sort of had that third party perspective to look at and say, yeah, I think this is what this is about. So
that's
really
neat.
Grateful for her for that.
I'm reading actually right here. I have Wayne Dyer's I like Wayne Dyer, but this is 10 Secrets for Success and Inner Peace. And one of his things that you just talking to reminded me of is be open to anything and attached to nothing.
Hmm.
And so many people are just attached to the kind of their belief, their how, their whatever it is, right? I have to do it this way. And it sounds like you've made so many different pivots, including with this book, that just you're kind of going with the flow.
Well, learn, right? I mean, that's sort of the whole thing about life, right? Is are you constantly learning and challenging what you know and being open to new information? As I like to say, I consider myself one of the more innovative people when it comes to thinking about sales. And it's ironic because I'm old. You know, I'm closer to the end of my career than the beginning. Where are all the young people thinking innovatively about this?
And well, they're on TikTok selling.
Well, but it's part of my mission with the book is to get people to think differently about sales and to encourage younger people who are newer in the profession to think differently about selling. So one of the things I do is just sort of a way to give back to the community a bit is I run a mastermind group for aspiring sales authors. And we've gone through, we're just getting close to finishing the second cohort going through the program. I do it free of charge. And because I want to bring new voices into this profession and people with different life experiences, people that see it differently. Because everything sort of seemed to be coming vanilla. And it's like, we don't need vanilla. We need different flavors and we need to encourage people to express these. So we've first group, we had about six or seven, the second one, we'll be starting another one and another cohort probably around March, April, just a 6-month program, you know, help people organize themselves to write a book that says something about, how do we do better in this profession? And so it's exciting to see people. And we started loosely, we're trying to have people under the age of 40, first sales book, the age range is somewhat there, but it's exciting to see the ideas that people have. And we just need more of that, right? And if you're a sales leader listening to this, you know, just going back to the point we were talking about before, is you have to realize that your success, I know you've been taught this, but you really need to internalize it. You succeed if your people succeed. And the way your people are going to succeed is you give them the agency to make choices about how they want to sell. And so they learn how to sell in a way that's aligned to their unique human strengths. Because they're gonna be different for every person. Mine are different than yours, right? I mean, you can't sell like me. I can't sell like you. That's fine. All we care about at the end of the day is the results. Yet somehow we've become convinced over the last 10 and 20 years that it's the process that wins and not the people. And that's just a fallacy. People still win.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't agree with you more. So when you're saying that you're considered a thought leader, do you actually set time in a day to think? Like, what's your process for thinking? Like, are you intentional with that?
Sometimes, you know, it's easy to get swept up in what's going on day to day, but we have a commitment to saying we, my team and I is that I'm going to post a certain number of times each week on LinkedIn. And so we try to, that's a good spur. So I try to post twice a day if I can. Not always able to do it, but that's our plan. And that's how you get, you know, build engagement, build a brand for yourself. You know, for, and it, I would urge people, not just people who consider themselves thought leaders, but anyone who's in sales these days, is to pay particular attention how you're building your brand on that platform of LinkedIn, how you're creating, being intentional about creating content and sharing that content with people out there, because that's going to become an increasingly important part of how your buyers and potential employers evaluate you. And so if you're not, and this has changed a lot just in the last few years, you know, a handful of years ago, you said, well, sellers need to create content. Sales leaders go, well, sales leaders still start saying, I'm telling you, as an individual,
just go sell.
Yeah, just go sell. As an individual seller, you need to pay attention to this. You need to be taking steps to build your brand, and don't leave it too late. You know, there's a study done last year, and a book was published last year. 82% of buyers look up a seller on LinkedIn before they talk with them for the first time.
Yep.
So they're doing that. And what are they looking for? Well, it's making a decision. Who are you? Yeah, I write about it in my book. I say that, you know, it's the first question that you have to answer for a buyer. And I tell them the form of a story, and we have time for one last story, is again, early in my career, I was out selling the construction industry. I was selling to this huge home builder. Well, I wanted to sell to this huge home builder in the Bay Area. And so I'd cold called on the CEO many times before. I'd never gotten in. I was in the area. I said, well, try it again. Fully expecting to be rebuffed. But to my surprise, the receptionist said, oh, he'll be right out. It's like, it's one of those like, oh shit moments. Like, you know,
yeah, really? He's coming.
He's coming. I was counting on him not being there. And so he comes out and gets me, and he's, you know, very successful, dressed extremely well, casually, you know, very expensive casual clothes that hung just perfectly on him and so on. He's an older gentleman, perfect tan. Walk into his office. He's got this huge desk the size of an aircraft carrier and completely clean on top. Give him my business card, and you know, I launch into my pitch. And he lets me go on for like 30, 45 seconds. He holds up his hand and says, stop. And he reaches into his top right-hand desk drawer and pulls out the stack of business cards about 2 inches high, bound by rubber band. He takes a rubber band off and he spreads them on top of the desk like a deck of playing cards. And he says, so, Mr. Paul, these are all the salespeople, computer salespeople, who have called on me in the last year. I'm looking, it's like, yeah, all my competitors and most of the other sellers in my branch office had been there at one time or another. And he said, and I haven't bought from any of them. Why should I buy from you? And it sort of dawned on me at that point. He said, what's it saying? Why should I buy from my company? He was saying, why should I buy from you? And I had no idea. I had no answer to the question, but it was this epiphany moment, right? Where it's like, oh, I got it. It's about me, right? And it's always been about me. It's always been about the seller. The buyers buy from you. And you know, there's been books written about this that are, you know, old books that are still incredibly valuable and right on. And the research has substantiated this. Is even the challenger sale, they talk about 53% of the purchase decision is based on the buyer's experience with you. And so
I'm surprised it's that low.
Yeah. Well, I think it could be higher. And, yeah. But I've had, you know, 7-8-figure deals that I won where the buyer said they basically bought because of me. I made them feel understood. I made them feel valued. And so, you know, you have to think about the first question that everybody asks you is, why you?
Why you?
Why should I trust you? Why should I invest my time in you? In the book, I have a list of questions that all start with the words why and end with the words you. And I tell you, just take all the words in the middle out. It's all the same question. Why you? And this is at the heart of selling. It's why you? Why should I invest my time in you? Why should I trust you? Why should I grant you the ability to have influence over the choices and trade-offs I make? Why you? And Wow. Yeah, the way you answer that question is through the experience you give to the buyer, how they experience you. You know, are you transparent about your motivations? Are you operating with integrity? I mean, if you say your motivations are there to help them, do your actions line up to your words? You know, do you have credibility? Do you have, you know, can you live up to your commitments? All these little things that add up to trust that get you to the next stage. So it's, you know, this buying experience, I sort of the heart of the book when you read through it and you'll think about it. So what it's saying is that, yeah, how do we have an impact on this buying experience the buyer has with us? And then if you take it sort of logical conclusion, well, that buying experience affects everything. Close rates, win rates, you know, go down the list, your ability to hit your numbers. There's this cascade of effects that if the customers have bad buying experience with you, you're not going to hit your numbers.
Wow. You make such good points. And by the way, I'm going to take you back just a little bit. For those of you who got inspired by Andy Paul's idea of posting twice a day, it's a very admirable goal. But if you're setting a goal to post the X amount of times during a week, make sure you set a goal to plan your posts as well. Because I made that mistake where I'm like, I'm going to post 3 times this week, but I did not schedule my time to plan my posts. And I did not post 3 times that week.
Well, but on top of that is you have to plan the time to engage with the people that comment. So it's not enough just the post.
Because it's
the engagement. So your goal is not just to throw your thoughts out there. Your goal is to get people to engage on those thoughts and to have conversations and perhaps have the conversations you want with people that you want to have be your prospects.
Wow, you just took mine a whole new level because, you know, for me, it was like, okay, so just to post, you need to schedule time to plan. Mm-hmm. Then you need to schedule time to post because that takes time. And now you also need to schedule time to respond and, you know, kind of connect with the people.
Yeah. And it's you have to experiment because you're going to find out what works and what doesn't, what resonates with people and what doesn't. And yeah, I mean, it's, you don't spend time on that platform, but again, how you are on that platform goes a long way to answering the question, why you?
Very, very true. So Andy, if you had to pick out your favorite chapter in your new book, could you give us a quick kind of, or like the number, like if there's the biggest reason why somebody should go buy your new book or pre-order, because it's available for pre-order now.
It's available for pre-order now, yeah.
Favorite. Awesome. So why your book? I'm gonna kind of send that back your way. Why you and why your book?
It'll give you a brand new perspective on this profession and what you can do to create positive buying experiences that help you win more business, because that's why we're there. And but to not just win more business, but do it in a way that's aligned with who you are as a person, that you'll find more fun and more fulfilling. Because, you know, one of the great tragedies of what's happening in sales today, it's just number of people that are suffering from, you know, stress and burnout and other mental health related issues that oftentimes stem from them trying to act and behave in ways that just aren't them. Right. And the book's an antidote to that. And it gives everybody not one way to sell, because there is not one way to sell. It gives them the answer to how do I sell the way that works for me
without selling out. I love the title.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Where can people go to pre-order your book and connect with you?
Well, order. So the 2 things to pre-order. You can come to my website and we've got some bonuses for people that pre-order the book. They pre-order it, come to the website, and enter a little bit of information. We're going to have some exclusive events and other things for people that pre-order. If you don't want the bonuses, just go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you buy books, and you can pre-order it there. And then if you want to connect with me, LinkedIn is the best place to do it. I also ask people to come by my website. We've got a manifesto that we're having people sign. We've had hundreds of people signed it so far in the last week and a half. Is sort of, we call it the Death to Salesy Manifesto. And it's, yeah, this way that we as sellers sort of get unfairly tarred with this brush of being, you know, sleazy and unreliable and clueless and so on. And it's unfair that buyers have these perceptions, but the perceptions are based on their experiences. So let's change those experiences. Let's commit ourselves to changing. And we can do that instantly.
Yes, we can. Andy, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, Eric, thank you very much.
I had a blast with you.
Yeah. Likewise, a lot of fun. Do a great job.
Good luck with your new book.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've listened to another episode of Lead, Sell, Grow, the Human Experience podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a nice review. And if you're not a part of our tribe on Facebook, be sure to head over to Facebook and join Lead, Sell, Grow, the Human Experience tribe. I look forward to speaking with you in the tribe. Have a great day.